All right, we're going to begin. I want to welcome everyone to the House Committee on Judiciary. Want to announce that we're excusing Representative Shetterly today. He is actually in New Orleans, Louisiana, attending a wedding, and will be gone today and tomorrow. Do you want to go ahead and tell us how to pronounce that, Representative?
No, Mr. Chair, I was just hoping that he was going to be bringing us back some gumbo or some other Cajun delights.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. I don't think those frozen beverages will stay solid on the plane. But he will be back with us on Monday. I think otherwise we're all here. It's certainly our pleasure today to have with us members from the court, from that important branch of government that we spend a lot of time working with here on this committee. And we'll just move into the agenda right now. I would ask that the Chief Justice come forward, Justice Carson, Justice Gillette from the Supreme Court, and also Presiding Judge of the Court of Appeals, Judge Dietz. And I believe the Chief Justice is going to introduce everybody for us that's going to be presenting today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House Judiciary Committee. We're all pleased to be here, and I will indeed introduce our team. To my immediate right is Justice W. Michael Gillette, who is the Senior Associate Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and he will open up the discussion on a kind of a broad-based rule of law concept. Seated next to him is Chief Judge Mary Dietz, and she's the leader of the Court of Appeals, which is one of the busiest courts in the country, and one of the best, in my view. Then we'll have Henry Breithaupt, who is the tax court judge, will come and talk to you about tax court matters. And then from Lane County, the Honorable Karsten Rasmussen, who was in the legislature a few years ago, but now is a circuit court judge. And then Kingsley Flick, if we have time, is here for, actually, she advises me when you ask questions I can't answer. I'll call her up here and help me out. I will point out that there is a handout. You've got a handout. To which I'll make a single reference, or maybe two, that has probably all you wanted to know and then some about the Oregon court system. And it's some very interesting statistics. I always feel obliged to give the disclaimer that we all are familiar with a statistician that drowned in a river with an average depth of 2 feet. So take these. They're intended to be forthright and straightforward, and I believe that they are. But they're available to you, and there's more information there than you need, perhaps. But it's a good collection of materials to give you a better understanding, and we'll shorten our presentation. We won't have to do a full Civics 101 for you. And I realize that some of you know the system as well or better than I, and some of you have not had the opportunity to work in the court system. Even though you might be a lawyer, might not have had court experience. So let me first turn to Mick, W. Michael Gillette, who will open up the conversation. And by the way, I'm sure the chair has pointed out that you're certainly free to ask questions as we go along. I often say my wife and I raised 3 children, and I'm quite content in being interrupted before I complete a full thought. So just come at us if you care to, or join with us. I'd rather make sure we talk about things you want to talk about. With that introduction, Justice Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mick Gillette, an Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court. And as it happens, Mary Dietz, immediate predecessor on the Court of Appeals, since Mary took my place when I moved from that court to the Supreme Court. So there's a continuity here that's downright terrifying when I think about it. Mr. Chairman, the Chief Justice asked me to speak for a few minutes to the committee, not about the mechanics by which the Oregon judiciary works, but rather about the idea of a judiciary and an independent judiciary, period. In doing so, I do not wish either to talk up or to talk down to anybody, but simply to offer one person, and it's only one person's point of view, with respect to a phenomenon which seems to be increasingly under attack in this state, and according to my readings throughout the United States, the idea of an independent judiciary. Now, One of the interesting things about government in Oregon is that we're referred to as the judicial department, which I think creates the impression on the part of some that we are like any other department of the executive branch of the government. And whatever else it is we are, we're not that. We're separated. Our powers are separated from the powers of the legislature and the executive by the Constitution, and there is a reason for that and a meaning to that that I'd like to speak to fairly quickly. But the word that I want to concentrate on to begin with is the phrase judicial independence. Because I think a great many people hear and misunderstand what the idea of judicial independence is supposed to stand for. As I read critical press and as I listen to critical radio and television comments with respect to what judges do, I get the impression that to the extent that the people who are being critical deal with the phrase judicial independence at all, their emphasis is on the word independence. And their idea is that judges feel free to do as they please, that judges do not feel constrained by any rule or set of rules, but that judges simply operate as a sort of roving band of brigands to create disaster in the legislative and constitutional ranks. And I want to offer you about 10 minutes of history and observation in an attempt to put you in a frame of mind which might make you at least willing to accept the suggestion that, one, we're not quite so free-roving, and secondly, for the most part, most of us don't feel that that's the kind of behavior judges ought to or indeed do engage in. We're talking here about a separate branch of the government under the Constitution of this state. And the Constitution of the United States also has its government divided into three separate branches. And the key here is that we're talking about constitutions. And what's the Constitution? Well, that's sort of straightforward and impossible to explain at the same time. But I would suggest to you that the way to think about constitutions is to think about them as being the fundamental societal deal. It's the social contract. It's the deal that we have struck with ourselves. We've said that in order to organize and maintain a civilized society, we're going to operate under a series of rules, some of which are going to be so fundamental that they will be observed at the expense of all other lesser rules. And that's what a constitution really is. It's the fundamental deal. It's the fundamental promise that we've made to ourselves generation after generation as to how we will relate to each other, how we will create other rules for the organization and ordinance of society, and what we will do about violations of those rules. The federal constitution is such a deal, and the state constitution is such a deal. There is a distinction in the two kinds of constitution, federal and state, and I apologize again if I'm doing civics 101, but this seems necessary to touch upon at least. In theory, the federal constitution, because it is a constitution which was made with the permission of 13 independent states, the federal constitution is a constitution of limited powers. It's a constitution by which the 13 original states granted to a central government certain powers and reserved to themselves all other powers. That was the idea, anyway. Hasn't quite worked out that way in practice, but everybody was entitled to hope. And still, conceptually, the federal constitution is written as a constitution of limited powers. It affirmatively describes those things which government can do, and by implication reserves everything else to the states or to the people. The state constitutions, and of course every state had a constitution eventually, Rhode Island was the last, it operated under its royal charter until sometime in the 1830s, but every state now has a constitution, and state constitutions differ in this fundamental respect. States have authority to do everything that their constitutions do not forbid. So that a state has, we say, plenary authority to legislate with respect to any subject it pleases and to otherwise govern the lives of its citizens in any way it pleases, subject to one thing only, subject to the limitations that appear in the Constitution. That's what the Constitution is for, to provide the limitations that people have agreed to place upon themselves and upon their government. And that, for us as judges, is the way we look at the Constitution. This Constitution of the State of Oregon is the fundamental agreement first made by the people of this state in 1857 and approved by the Congress in 1859, by which the people of the state agreed to govern themselves, and a document which placed limitations on the way in which people would govern themselves. And so the Constitution has served ever since. We make it real easy to amend our Constitution so that as a fundamental document, it's not quite as fundamental as the federal one, which is very difficult to amend, but nonetheless, it's still the fundamental deal. It controls everything else. And when we judges are called upon, as a judge is from time to time, in a case in which real people are arguing over a real issue, when we judges are called upon to determine what the Constitution means, we approach the Constitution in that light and with that understanding. The Constitution is the fundamental deal. The Constitution is the deal that everyone struck and that everyone has, by implication, agreed to live by ever since. It's not the deal we created. It might not even be the deal we would want to create. But it's the deal. It's the promise. It's the social contract. And it is to be obeyed first. And so when a judge is called upon to determine whether something is, quote, constitutional, close quote, a judge is not placed at large to simply say, well, you know, I don't like it, or it's Tuesday, it's unconstitutional. That's not the way it works. And indeed, it's not what we do. What we're responsible for doing instead is laying the wording of the particular legislative enactment or initiative or agency rule or regulation, laying that alongside the wording of the Constitution, which it is said to offend, to try to determine what the wording of the Constitution means in that respect, and if indeed the initiative or the legislation or the regulation offends that constitutional provision, it has to be struck down, not because we wish to, and frequently not because we would like to, but simply because the Constitution requires it. If we don't do that, we don't honor the deal. And society becomes something else. Not a bad society, necessarily, but a society more like England, in which, with an unwritten constitution, they can change the rules, even the fundamental ones, even every time Parliament decides to. Here we can't. Here the Constitution governs. What is key for us, and what I would hope that you would accept for the moment, is this idea. At least since soon after the founding of the American Republic, the responsibility of judges to decide what the Constitution's state and federal mean, and to rule that laws which are inferior to those and which violate them cannot be enforced, that duty is fundamental and necessary. Somebody has to do it. If there is a struggle between two reasonable but opposing forces over the meaning of a constitution, only one of which force can be right, somebody has to decide. We do that in this society. That is the role of a judge. If you believe, if it appears to you, that on occasion the judges make that decision based upon their personal, religious or philosophical or political point of view, there's nothing I can do to keep you from believing that. I can tell you that it isn't so. At least it isn't so in Oregon. I can tell you, frankly, that it is so with respect to certain judges in other places, because I know them. And I know that they make their decisions on some of these kinds of questions based upon other criteria. But for us, we try to take into our heart and into our soul and to evince in what we write, in our opinions, this fundamental idea that the Constitution is the deal. And our responsibility is to identify what that agreement was and continues to be, and to make it work. If legislation is in accordance with it, and keep in mind that under the state constitution, unless the constitution forbids it, legislation by definition is permissible, because you have plenary authority to legislate on anything else. If the legislation is consistent, that's what we'll say. If the legislation is not, we will say it is not, and we always say it reluctantly. Believe it or not, we always say it reluctantly, because we just assume, in spite of the idea of checks and balances, we just as soon be balanced without checking. It is not, we do not live to check the executive or legislative branches, but we exist to do it. The difference is between an obligation and a personal motive. The obligation is constitutional itself, and we intend to live by it and enforce it. But as to personal motive, I can't think of, I know some of you really reasonably well, and there's none of you toward whom I hold such animus that I would wish to strike down a bill that you sponsored simply because you sponsored it. It's just not the way that we think about the problem. Now, Mr. Chairman, this has been, in a sort of shotgun way, the world's quickest discussion of the idea of why judges conduct constitutional review and what our claimed justification for doing so is. I would add only one thing to it before offering myself to questions from the committee if you wish to approach it that way, and that's this thought. When the American Revolution was fought, one of the things that the Declaration of Independence mentioned as an ill that had befallen the colonies at the hands of the Crown was the fact that the Crown sent the Crown's judges to decide on the legal affairs of the colonists. And the colonists had the sense that a judge who was in the pay of the Crown would rule for the Crown. And so the response in Article 3 of the Federal Constitution, which is reflected to a degree in Article 7 of the Oregon Constitution, the response was to make judges independent so that at least American judges would no longer have to be dependent upon the goodwill of the Parliament and the King, the President and the Congress, the Governor and the Legislature, for their ability to survive. And that level of independence that they were granted instead would assure that they would have the freedom to obey the obligation that they undertook anyway, which was to make the Constitution work in the face of, sometimes adamantine, opposition by both the other two branches of government. I like to think that in the main, Mr. Chairman, we have kept the faith with respect to that. But more than that, I'd like to think that when you think about it, you would want us to.
Thank you very much, Justice Gillette. Are there questions for the Justice?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Excuse me. I'm just curious. Why is the Oregon Judicial Department called the Oregon Judicial Department and not the Oregon Judicial Branch?
Representative Crowell, Mr. Chairman, I don't have the foggiest idea. It seemed like a bad idea at the time, and I really don't know why they did it. There's also a suggestion in the Oregon Constitution that the administrative branch of government is a fourth branch. It doesn't really seem to have worked out that way in practice. We've never treated it like that, but it's just one of those interesting historical accidents. Now, I say that with deference to my colleague, the Chief Justice, who, being older and wiser,
you're half right.
Although he was not present at the time, may have information that I don't with respect to that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, no, I don't have specific mention. It probably came from Indiana, and they probably, because that's where most of our Constitution came from. It is true they talk about the legislative branch, the executive branch, including, the legislative department, the executive department, and including the administration department. That's the reference he made, and then the judicial department. So we are technically a department, constitutionally a department. We would prefer that to be called branch, to delineate us from the Parks Department or some of the other branches. I get mail, dear agency head, and I hope it's not my ego breaking through, but I just say, well, they're missing it. They don't understand the fine balance between the three branches or the three departments. It just is the way it's always been.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You may.
It actually is a constitutional name as opposed to something that, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, the legislature said, yeah, let's call them the department. It actually is in the Constitution as a judicial department. But yet the other two branches are identified as branches, correct? The executive and the...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, no, that's not quite what they're called, and I'm trying to remember now the phrasing. I wish I'd thought about this and had checked, but my recollection is we are the only one of the three that's referred to as a department, and I may be mistaken about that. But at all events, I do have to note that we take liberties with respect to a number of things. We don't think we're taking a liberty when we claim to be a separate branch of government, but we do take a liberty when I claim to be, for example, an associate justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. The Constitution said there should be a chief justice and such associate judges, not justices. And we sort of amalgamated the better sounding title, so we cheat a little bit. But my recollection is that we're the only one that's called a department. I may be wrong. It may very well be that all three are, Representative Crowell.
I believe, at least with respect to the legislative branch, it's often referred to as the assembly, and I think maybe that's how they got around it, but I thought there was a lot of reference to assembly, and I don't know about the executive, but we have a constitution of the state of Oregon in this little purple book, Representative Cremon. I'd be happy to let you borrow it and read through any time you want.
I actually have a copy of the constitution in my office, and when I have a moment, I may look at it. But it's just one of those curiosities, because I think that there is a
It does mislead people.
It does, very much so.
Yeah, and we'll hear in a few minutes from the Department of Justice, which is different than the Judicial Department, and that tends to confuse a lot of people, I think, as well in the process.
Right. And I think even some of our colleagues in the Assembly, both in the House and the Senate, may be confused the difference between a branch and a department.
Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be enlightening, since we're talking basically about the separation of powers, to have some statement from the appellate judges regarding the concept of judicial restraint, because it does have a lot to do with what we do here. And I think it would be enlightening for not only the lawyers but the lay members of the committee to hear that concept.
Do you want to? Maybe Mary could.
That's okay. I'll pass it on.
You'll pass it. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, legislative or judicial restraint probably has a counterpart called legislative restraint, but I won't go there. What it means to me, that's one of the problems of talking about conservative or activist or original intent. It's usually in the eye of the beholder, and so, but judicial restraint is generally, to me, means you don't go there if you don't have to. And where it usually plays, and I've had conversations over the years with friends in the legislature who think that we tend to reach out for decide things that you've passed, not you necessarily personally, but the legislature, and that we do it with glee, and that's not so. We don't give advisory opinions, as you know. We wait for a case and controversy to come to us. And quite frankly, I think we are very restrained. That's my own personal view, and it may not be shared by anybody else in this room, but we do try to follow the legislative intent. I remember one case we had, and I've forgotten the name now. It was a workers' comp case. When I first got on the court, I didn't participate. But it was in those days, there was a lump sum benefit of $50,000 payable to the widow. That was a long time ago, as Tameka suggested. And the case came up, a widower wanted his $50,000 on the death of the worker. And the court split. Everybody said, seven said, it's unconstitutional to make that distinction between husband and wife. The majority of the court said, we'll fix it. We'll just say widow means widower. The other said, no, that's a legislative problem. Now, had I voted, I would have been in the latter category. It's your job to fix it, and we don't do it. There are times we would say, that's really a stupid policy. But it's your policy, and that's what you get to do. And I believe that. And over time, we've had several people on the court who have been legislators. And we don't do policy work. You do policy work. And then we try to understand what it is you said and what it is you mean and try to be faithful with that. So I think we do practice judicial restraint. I realize there are people, your colleagues over here, that think we're the riding free upon the land doing injustice, but that's just not true.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, if I could add to that, to the Chief Justice's remarks briefly. Restraint exists in two forms. One is personal and the other is institutional. An individual may be restrained with respect to the degree to which he or she writes or tries to deal with the problem. Institutional restraint is imposed upon us in one sense by the fact that we can't go looking for trouble. You all serve here because you have offered yourselves to your constituencies and said, I stand for these things, and when I go to the legislature, I will vote in accordance with what I say that I stand for. In our situation, that's not our position at all. We can't say, we'll go to the court and vote this way or that way. We don't even know if a case is ever going to show up involving any particular subject. We have to wait until a case comes to us in order to decide it. And in deciding it, I think it is accurate to say, particularly with respect to my court, that we try very hard to find the least expansive correct answer that we can give for just the reason that is implied by your question. There may be three different answers, all of which would announce the same result, one of which is extremely expansive. It says, the law with respect to this part of the world from now on shall be this. Then another slightly more restrictive answer, which says, the law on this in cases having a first-cousin relationship will be like this. And then finally, there is the answer that says, with respect to this problem presented in this guise under these facts and circumstances, here's the answer. Our tendency on our court is to give the latter of those kinds of answer. Not always, because sometimes we don't have any choice. Sometimes only the broad question is presented to us. But we tend, if we possibly can, to give the narrowest answer possible for a simple reason. We recognize that we're profoundly fallible, and the more broadly we pronounce, having been given only a narrow factual basis from which to proceed, the higher the likelihood that our pronouncement will exceed what the answer should have been once we've been presented with a further set of scenarios. We try very hard to be restrained in that sense. And, Mr. Chairman, if judicial restraint means something, that's probably what it ought to mean. It ought to mean that the court, aware of its own fallibility, doesn't take an opportunity to speak far more broadly than the case called for. And I'm prepared to defend my court in that respect, with respect to virtually any example anyone can offer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question is, and I'm not sure that you can answer this, but doesn't the process we sometimes use, especially in the absence of a position on the court during the middle of a term, sometimes threaten the independence of the court, or at least the perceived independence of the court?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I'm not sure I fully understand your question. We do have vacant seats occasionally when somebody retires and before the governor has made the appointment or the election has taken place.
That's what I'm referring to.
Okay. Well, yes, temporarily we have six, and so it's possible that we would tie 3-3, and that has an impact. We have a because we recuse ourselves if we've had anything to do with the case, and occasionally, once, we get an attorney general that has been, now has another position, that has been involved in cases and recuses himself. So in the period of, the last 5 years, 6 years, we had a number of cases where we were down to six, and then we'd tie, and we would affirm by an evenly divided court if we couldn't get a majority. So, yes, it does have an impact. And, of course, one of my responsibilities is to encourage the governor to make a rapid appointment so that we're back up to the full seven.
If I may ask.
You may.
Follow. But I think it's the question really is getting to the fact that the governor makes the appointment.
Indeed.
That threatens the independence of the court or the perceived independence.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, that certainly I'll acknowledge the potential for that. And, of course, there was a bill last session or session before for Senate confirmation of the gubernatorial appointments. My answer is that, no, it doesn't make a difference. I argued against the Senate confirmation, although I had once been a state senator, because it just added another hurdle to get people on the bench. And my concern was the model that they were looking at, I think, was the U.S. Senate. And if you want to politicize something, all you have to do is look for the right shore or the right coast, and that is perhaps more political than the governor. I was initially appointed to the circuit court by Bob Straub, a Democrat, and then I was appointed to the Supreme Court by Victor Atiyah, a Republican. I like to think they both made good appointments, and it was a nonpartisan appointment. And I believe that is generally true whenever the governor makes an appointment. The governors in this state have taken the appointment of judges to heart, and I think have done a good job in appointing people. And it's becoming more practical that the Constitution reference, the positions are now being elected. In fact, as you know, this body, whenever we add new judges, the present practice here is to postpone the establishment of a new judicial position until after the election, so it will not be by gubernatorial appointment. But there is always the risk that the governor will appoint somebody who is totally political, and I contend they have not done so.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your explanation of the Constitution, both federal and state. To a non-legal mind, that's been very helpful. Recently in the media, there were write-ups of a case in which there was a charge that there were different oaths regarding the Constitution. Could you explain to me where the oath comes from, and are there different oaths, or is it one oath that hasn't been applied, or just some clarification on that?
I'll take it, Mr. Chairman, Representative Henderson. I'll take the question because it probably will get to our court. It's on the way up.
Oh.
And I'm going to recuse myself because I've been in that problem from the outset. There's now a fight going on between amended Article 7, which is the one since 1910, I think, that we're operating the courts under, and the original. And each one of those has an oath, and they're substantially the same. The flap started when it was discovered by some investigation that the oaths that we got from the Secretary of State's office left out two words, and impartially. Our oath, like the one I delivered earlier this week, says in part, I name, do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, and that I will faithfully, the Constitution says, and impartially. And the oaths we got from the Secretary of State decided to edit the Constitution, was his real stroke, and took out and impartially. And that's where the fight started. So I think most of us redid our oath. And by the way, my understanding is the Secretary of State knew about it for some time before ever changed and complied with the Constitution. So the argument goes that we didn't take the right one, the original Article 7 now, or the one we took, and I think most of us have retaken the oath, so it's on there, that everything we did is void. And that's the arguments that are being made because of the Constitution. We didn't take the constitutional oath. Oddly enough, almost everybody I know did when I was in the room because they did it orally. But when the one we signed, provided by the Secretary of State, left it out.
Great. Thank you.
So you'll be hearing about this for some time to come. It's like the fifth argument in every case, and so we'll be working on it.
Further questions before we move on to Judge Dietz from the Court of Appeals? Please proceed.
Could I interrupt?
I think the Chief was...
Well, let me just... you know how to get a hold of me. I was going to... the materials we gave out, we need to catch up a little time. If any of you have any questions, give me a call or ask me to come over, and I'll be delighted to do so. So I'll just... my part and go right immediately to...
Well, if you had... No, truly.
No,
had something else you needed to address the committee, we want to take the time.
Well, I appreciate that, but I was going to do that anyway. And that is, we need to catch up sometime. And so, with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll just forego my sterling remarks and turn it to Judge Dietz, Chief Judge Dietz.
At your direction.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. In looking at the committee, I think many of you are really quite familiar with the operations of the Court of Appeals. But just quickly, for those of you who might not be, a few basics. We are a 10-judge statewide court. And basically, we hear, with the exception of some limited cases that go directly to the Supreme Court or to the tax court, we hear all appeals from any of the state's trial courts or administrative agencies. And citizens have a right to appeal to our court. We do not exercise discretion as to what we will hear. We pretty much hear all of our cases by three-judge panels, and the cases are heard and decided by these panels. About 5% of the cases that we do take under advisement are considered by the full 10 judges on our court. And as the Chief Justice mentioned, we are one of the busiest intermediate appellate courts in the United States. There are 36 states that have intermediate appellate courts. And both in terms of filings per citizen and filings per judge, Oregon has for a long time been among the most overloaded intermediate appellate courts in the United States. We generally, over the last 10 years, we've averaged about 4,000 notices of appeal filed per year. One of the priorities of our court has been to try and make our docket as current as we can, because we realize it's not to anybody's benefit to have their cases slowly winding their way through the legal system. And we worked very hard on this. And at this time, since I came on the court in 1986, I did replace Justice Gillette in 1986 on our court. We are the most current that we've ever been on the Court of Appeals. The vast majority of our decisions are made in about 3 to 4 months period. Right now, I was looking right before I came over, we have 5 cases that are over a year old, and most of those are fairly close to coming out. Our goal is to have no cases over a year old, and I think we will achieve that goal fairly soon. One of the reasons that I think we've done a better job in managing our workload is we do have an appellate settlement program. I don't know if many of you are familiar with that, but that has really been an effective way to deal with our caseload. Last year, for example, we settled 150 cases. These were cases that the court would have had to address and write decisions on. And they tend to be the cases that go into the program and settle tend to be some of the more complex civil cases, which are things that would really take a great deal of time for the court to consider. Not only does it help our workload, but in the feedback that we get from individuals who participate in our settlement program, I think more often than not, the parties end up happier, both sides end up happier with a result that they both agreed to. So we think that that is a really effective program. The Supreme Court also has been participating in the settlement program. Another priority area of the court that I just want to point out is that we do recognize that we are a statewide court, and we believe we have the responsibility to try and make the Court of Appeals more accessible and more understandable to the citizens of Oregon. To do that, we've developed an outreach program that some of you might be familiar with. Perhaps we've been in your community, where we do sit in various communities throughout the state of Oregon. This has really been, I think, a very successful program. We've been well received by the high schools and the communities, and we plan to continue this program. Last fall, we sat, I think, in Baker City, Eugene, and Lake Oswego, and this spring we plan to go to Medford, David Douglas, and Newburgh. And if, in fact, any of you have a school that you would like us to visit, please feel free to contact me, and we'd be glad to do that. And I have to say, the Supreme Court does this as well. In fact, they did it before we did, but I don't think they go out into the community quite as often as we do, but we're very pleased with that program. One final thing I want to note, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have, is another area of priority for the court is cases involving children. As I mentioned, we recognize the harm to citizens when their cases take a long time to go through the court system. We particularly recognize the harm to children when they have cases that are affecting their lives that are sitting in the court system. So what we've been doing is, in the last year or so, is we've developed a program to try and really move cases involving children through the Court of Appeals. We no longer give extensions for any transcripts or preparation of briefs in cases, in termination cases or dependency cases. And we also give priority to those cases in our decision-making process. And through these procedures, we've cut down significantly on the time that it takes for juvenile cases to go through our court. And we feel good about that. We're going to continue to work on that, but it has been a priority of our court. I think we'll end at that unless you have questions.
The one thing that might be helpful for some of the new members of the committee would be to explain, and I know the process is similar but perhaps just a little different between the two appellate courts, how a particular opinion gets assigned to a particular judge. And it might be helpful also to get a sense of the kind of, at the Court of Appeals level, for example, the caseload that a particular judge on the Court of Appeals might have at any one particular time. Could you just maybe take a second and explain that, Judge Dietz?
Sure. We set up our argument days. Generally, we sit about 9 days during each month, and each day we hear anywhere from 15 to 30 cases during that day. And then the particular panel that hears the case will meet both before argument and after argument. After argument, the presiding judge of the panel will assign the case to one of the members of the panel. Basically, we all do everything. We don't have a criminal expert or particularly a land use expert. We feel it's best if everyone in the court does everything. So the assignments are pretty balanced in terms of what particular judges do. Typically, a judge will be carrying about 30 cases on their docket at one time that they're working on. When I first came to the court, it was more typical that judges would be carrying something like 100 cases because we were hugely backlogged at that time. But because we've gotten fairly current, I think most of us are down to something around 30 cases.
It might also help to explain that because a judge has been assigned to write an opinion, it doesn't mean that whatever he or she might write becomes the opinion. I mean, a little bit of that discussion might be helpful as well.
Right. We do conference. We meet about two times a month. Each of our panels meets, and the judge who is assigned the case presents the written draft to the other members of the panel. And at that time, there's a lot of back and forth, sometimes argument, some interesting discussions. And it's necessary, of course, to get one of the other judges on the three-judge panel to vote for that to become the majority. It's not uncommon that there are substantial rewrites that happen in the majority opinion that's presented, or that another judge will end up being assigned the case because the other judges simply don't agree with that opinion. I think Oregon is, interestingly, one of the few states where all of the court is officed in one building, in fact, in one floor. And so we have continuous face-to-face discussions of all of these opinions. Many other states, the judges, I don't know quite how they do this, but do not really get together in conference. They write each other memos or send emails or whatever you do. And I believe that because of the collaborative process we have and the discussion and feedback we all get from each other, that we end up with a better quality opinion. And a lot of time is spent, both staff time and judge time, in the development of any opinion.
Good. Thank you. Questions for Judge Deeds?
Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
I'd like to ask whether there is any pattern of fluctuation in the amount of appellate activity that comes to the appellate courts of the state, or is it pretty much steady over time in relation to the population and the amount of commercial or criminal activity in the state?
I would say that I was actually just looking at the statistics over the last 10 years. It remains fairly steady. There are fluctuations, often based on what you do. Right after session, we have lots of appeals involving what is the meaning of workers' comp law, and we have these upswings in workers' comp cases. And right now, for example, our workers' comp cases are way down because I think we're a long ways from session and from any changes in the law. It's funny, we do seem to have some real major swings in land use cases, and I can't quite figure that out. For a period about a year ago, we were getting six or seven land use cases every month, and now typically we'll get about two, and I'm not quite sure what that's about.
Mr. Chairman, may I offer my comments?
Please do.
I'll be brief. Representative McPherson, some years ago I spoke to the Judicial Administration Committee of the Bar, and the topic of my speech was, why is Oregon so appealing? And I was trying to get at the point, we have this excessive appeal rate per capita to which Chief Judge Dietz mentioned. And I have looked at it, and the overall amount has not changed much. They're a little down from their high water mark, which was outrageous in terms of appeals. And I'm not sure whether it's just the Oregon way, I want a second opinion, or the filing fees are too low, or we're just so doggone litigious that we're going to use the court system. But it is very high on a national standard, and in the Supreme Court, we've seen the same phenomenon. We're down to about 3% of our cases are workers' comp, and it used to run around 9 or 11. So anytime you make a major change in workers' compensation law, two or three years later, then our caseload will blossom in workers' comp, and then it quiets out. And so It's a phenomenon for which I can offer no reasonable response.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for being here and for your presentation, and we'll look forward to the remainder of the session having opportunities to work with you and the folks that represent you over here as we deal with this legislation. I know the chief is going to introduce our next part of the panel, so thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you both. I'd like to ask the Henry Breithop, the tax court judge, to come forward, and also Carson Rasmussen, who's a representative for the trial courts, the circuit courts, to join me, and why don't you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Henry Breithop, and I am the judge of the Oregon Tax Court. Very happy to be here today, among other reasons, to see a former partner of mine, Representative McPherson, proving that the way you get ahead in this state is to simply stay in one place and live long enough. I have been the judge of the Oregon Tax Court for approximately 18 months, so what I say is based on that amount of experience as the judge of the court and approximately 25 years of practicing from time to time before the court on a regular basis. The Oregon Tax Court was created in 1961 by the legislature, an effort which really brought to culmination discussions that had begun to occur just after the Second World War, and which recognized that, for better or worse, the law of taxation was enough of a specialized area that rather than have each circuit court judge deal with tax matters arising in their jurisdiction, it would be better to have a statewide court, hopefully the member or members of which would be have a special training or experience in tax law, to deal with those problems. That was a model which really existed at the federal level with the United States Tax Court and its predecessor, the Board of Tax Appeals. So in 1961, the Tax Court of Oregon was created as a specialized trial court with statewide jurisdiction, but limited jurisdiction limited to tax laws of this state. Oregon, in terms of having a court in the judicial branch or judicial department, is one of only approximately four or five states that has a specialized tax court in the judicial branch. A number of states have dispute resolution agencies that often exist within the Department of Revenue, for example, or within the executive branch. And there are a number of commentators at the national level now who are literally crying out for more and more states to do what Oregon did over 40 years ago, and that is create a specialized court for tax matters. So we are, in that respect, and as we always have been, I believe, in this state, we were a leader and remain a leader. As I said, the jurisdiction is on statewide, on a statewide basis involving tax issues. The court, since September of 1997, has had two divisions, and the chairman, Representative Williams, is well aware of the second of the divisions, the magistrate division, because I think the record shows that he was counsel to the judiciary committees at the time that this body, the legislature, decided that the initial hearing of a dispute, instead of occurring inside the Department of Revenue, the administrative agency, should occur in the judicial branch. And so the magistrate division was created by the 95 legislature to go into effect as it did on September 1, 1997. Essentially, again, first hearing of a dispute moves to the judicial branch. The magistrate division is currently composed of six magistrates. They are appointed by the tax court judge. They are all lawyers. Appeals are filed with the magistrate division, essentially the bulk of them directly from county boards of property tax appeals on property tax matters, or from actions of the Department of Revenue with respect to income tax matters. Very low filing fees, $25. The magistrate division was initially created and continues to operate on a semi-formal basis. It is user-friendly. It is accessible. People are not required to be represented by a lawyer. They may represent themselves. They may have their accountant represent them, a qualified appraiser, an employee regularly engaged in tax matters. The procedures of the court at the magistrate level are relatively informal. Most matters are handled over the telephone. There is a substantial amount of formal and informal alternative dispute resolution, as the saying goes. By that I mean a magistrate, and we have six very good magistrates, is often the first person in the discussion who is able to get people to talk once, one at a time, ask for something, have the other person listen, provide the document, the case is resolved. The magistrates resolve a large number of cases on a very informal basis and a basis acceptable to both parties. On the other hand, at times, the magistrate goes through a process that I think, if you watched it, you would not be able to distinguish it from the regular division judge, and ends up, as in all cases that go to decision, writing a decision. In that respect, the regular division judge and the magistrates all are expected to and do write out their decisions. If either party, after the magistrate has issued a decision, if either side is unhappy, they may bring the case to the regular division. That's my division of the court, where the case is heard anew. The only thing I get is a copy of the magistrate's decision, but that is for information purposes. I do not review that decision in the way that the Chief Justice or Judge Dietz and her court review decisions of the circuit court judges. I start fresh and reach a decision based on the evidence that's presented in the court and the arguments that are made. There is a greater level of formality in the regular division. The rules of evidence are more strictly applied, then, again, a decision is reached and issued in writing. Some cases, notably cases involving the constitutional property tax limitations, local budget law matters, come directly to the regular division of the court and bypass the magistrate division. The court is a statewide court, and where it is possible to do so, either magistrates or the regular division travel to other locations, especially where a taxpayer has a lawyer and maybe witnesses or an accountant in Pendleton. The court goes to Pendleton and tries to hear one or more cases and make that an expression of the statewide character of the court. Budget considerations sometimes limit that, but we try to do that when we can. The tax court model is one in which once a decision is reached by the regular division judge, myself, the appeal is a matter of right directly to the Oregon Supreme Court, not through the Court of Appeals. And when I say a matter of right, unlike unlike the traditional model in which the Supreme Court chooses which cases to review, a taxpayer dissatisfied with my decision may, as a matter of right, appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court and have the case reviewed. That has been true since the beginning of the tax court's existence. About 1995, I believe, the scope of review was somewhat made somewhat more narrow, but that is the pattern for the process of a tax case. I will say, for the benefit of all the committee, but especially Representative Williams, that both as a practitioner who practiced before the magistrate division and now as, in effect, the person to some extent responsible for that division, I believe that what I understand to be the goals that the legislature had at the time of the establishment of the division have been more than satisfied. And I believe it is doing that division is performing marvelously. It is allowing people access to a fair and prompt resolution. And the goal that every one of the magistrates has is to have both parties feel that they had their day in court, a fair hearing, and the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. My wife says the phrase is the proof of the pudding. The proof is in the pudding. But anyway, the proof of the pudding is that only less than 10% of the cases the magistrates decide come on to my level of the court. So 90% of the matters are resolved in a way that, by definition, is acceptable to both parties.
I'm going to interrupt you now. Yes. So we can go there. Okay.
Thank you very much, and I'm quite willing to answer questions.
Thank you, Judge Breithaupt. We appreciate it. Question, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, is the scope of the review statutory or determined by the court?
The scope of the review by the tax court or by the Supreme Court?
Review by the Supreme Court.
The scope of review of decisions of the tax court is set by the Oregon statute, and it is on matters of fact or questions of fact. The scope of review is to determine if there is substantial evidence in the record supporting the decision, and then on law, if I've made an error.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Judge Rasmussen.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us here today. I know that your time is valuable. I'm going to try to keep my remarks fairly short. I am a circuit judge in Lane County. I've been pleased to serve in that capacity for 3.5 years. There are 163, I believe at last count, roughly that number of circuit judges in the state of Oregon. Compare that to the 17 in the appellate courts. And we are, of course, the trial judges and make all these decisions not by panel but by single votes, which I find most of the time I'm able to obtain my vote to make those decisions. And so it makes life, on the one hand, a lot easier, and on the other hand, makes your life a little different than perhaps when you sit down and consult with your colleagues, which we don't do as much of by definition, I think. We handle everything that comes in the door, and it's a long list, and I'm going to give you just a short version of it. Juvenile matters, FEDs, which is landlord-tenant disputes, misdemeanors, felonies, civil cases of all kinds, business disputes all the way from a dispute about a note with a value of $1,000 to the $350 million construction litigation arising out of the construction of Hyundai plant down in Lane County, which I was assigned to the day I got to the court. I think that was on the gravity theory of assignments. I'm not positive about that. But the point being, of course, that civil cases encompasses a large variety of cases, domestic relations cases, both of a temporary order nature when someone's coming to court and trying to get a temporary order pending a dissolution, as well as the final trial itself. FAPA, Family Abuse Prevention Act matters, civil commitments, probates, adoptions, small claims, violations. In fact, if you look at page 33 of your materials or care to simply reference that later, you'll see that in circuit court in 2001 there were 654,822 filings in circuit courts in the state of Oregon. 654,000 filings in the state of Oregon. And I think it's important to remember that number for the obvious reason, and that is that for the most part, the circuit courts is where the rubber hits the road. We are not courts that answer, for the most part, the big questions. We are given the answers, for the most part, to those questions by the appellate courts. And then we apply the law as interpreted by the appellate courts to the individual question that is brought to us for a decision. The overwhelming majority of the disputes in this state filed in courts are decided in the circuit courts of the state. In fact, in Lane County, just by way of example only, in 2002 there were over 38,000 filings. From those filings there were 250 appeals, and in the same year, not the same cases because of the time lag, but in the same year there were 15 decisions in the Court of Appeals where we were reversed now or remanded. Now that's not the only form of decision in the Court of Appeals, and I do not mean in any fashion to suggest anything other than what you've already heard here, which is that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of this state are very, very hard-working courts, and obviously the decisions I make on a daily basis are informed, at least I'll say here in front of the chief, on a daily basis by those decisions. So I don't think the numbers tell you the whole story, but the point is that in Lane County, which is about 6% of the circuit court work in the entire state. About 0.04% of our decisions result in reversals or remands to us. And again, my point simply is this, that most cases don't end up in the newspaper, and most cases do not end up in the appellate courts. We make decisions on a daily basis that resolve the dispute finally, and often even I had a case 2 weeks ago which resulted in a jury verdict award that was of some surprise to the defendant, and there were many, many rulings during that case on my part which could have formed the basis for discussion by Judge Dietz and her colleagues. But the result nonetheless was further discussion after the jury verdict and a subsequent settlement of the case, which I think happens a great deal of the time. So besides those cases which settle or are decided by us, there are also those cases which settle once an appeal is threatened or even once an appeal is commenced, and then we have the settlement processes that you've heard about from Judge Dietz and Justice Carson. I know you're pressed for time. My point, I think, is readily apparent in these numbers, and I would simply ask that during the year, as you go through the process of considering how to create new law or amend existing law, that you do something that I failed to do when I was in the Senate, which was call a circuit judge and ask, how will this really work? Because I got a call from a couple of circuit judges one time when I offered some legislation pointing out to me some things about how my proposed legislation would work in the real world out there on the circuit bench, and I appreciated the comments. They were helpful to me, and I'm certainly happy to be a resource to you, as I know all of my colleagues are. If you will be so kind as to call us, we'll not only come here but talk with you on the phone about how something might work in the world where you want it to be applied. I'll cut my comments short with that and entertain any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Judge. Questions? Representative Jensen.
Thank you. A couple of questions, if I may. What kind of a time delay would I expect in Lane County on a civil case filed today before it reaches trial?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I would expect that it depends first and foremost a great deal on the kind of case, but on, let's say, a business dispute arising out of the sale of and purchase of a business, I would expect your case to be filed today. It would be tried within 11 months, generally speaking. I would say our numbers at the 12-month mark are very, very close to 100%. There are going to be some exceptions to that, and I'm talking about the average civil case. The time frame for that in a number of cases is going to be much shorter, but in the average civil case, that's about the time frame.
I'm struck, Mr. Chair, there's a question about that number of cases. If I look at what you have here and do the arithmetic correctly, it's about one case filing for every 10 people in the state of Oregon, 300 and some thousand cases filed, and 3.5 million people in the state. Is that is my arithmetic correct? And is that somewhat normative as far as cases filed across the country?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I don't have any reason to think that the numbers are any different in Oregon in terms of litigiousness than they are elsewhere. We don't make 654,000 decisions a year. I suppose in some respects we make more because we rule on things during a trial. But there are a lot of cases that are filed and go by way of default. A lot of collection matters are kind of pro forma, so to speak. So I don't think the numbers, I have no reason to believe that the numbers are.
Would it be accurate also to say that some of those numbers on that raw number per total cases filed would also include violations?
Yes.
Would they not? So,
Mr. Chairman, they do.
So a violation, Representative Jensen, which could be as minor as a traffic infraction, could be something that would trigger a case. Now, that it really is a case for purposes of how it's processed through the courts, but it isn't necessarily a case that's going to take a significant amount of time by a sitting circuit court judge. But, in you know, somebody's got to handle the traffic court stuff as well, and that's done depending on, and we'll get a whole discussion at some point of how that happens, because it's different around the regions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I understand kind of that, but I'm still struck that with the volume. I mean, if it's just a traffic thing, then we've got a lot of traffic violators, or just anyone. Sorry, the volume of cases strikes me as very large.
And I want to take just a second, and we are starting to run a little behind on our schedule, but to comment that Judge Rasmussen was kind enough to answer your question on how soon your typical case would get to trial without even referencing the realities of the budget situation we're under, because my suspicion is that answer is what would happen at this very moment, assuming that the budget cuts resulting from what we did in the fifth special session and the impact of the failure of Measure 28 would have on that time frame. But as the court begins to prioritize, which we're going to talk about in another meeting, there are a number of those civil cases that, frankly, are just going to be put on the back burner while they deal with the more pressing criminal matters. So that number will change dramatically if things don't change. Is that an accurate statement, Mr. Chief?
Chairman, absolutely.
Okay.
That was part of the reason, if I might, Mr. Chair,
please.
For the asking the question, because we are possibly entering into a different world, and I just wanted some sort of clarification where we're at right
That's
now.
That's good. Representative Prozanski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a point of clarification, since I am familiar with the Lane County Court, and Judge Rasmussen, please correct me if I'm wrong. One of the things that, really for all the courts in this state, a criminal docket is going to get precedent over a civil docket as to how quickly something goes to trial. And so that, in effect, will affect, or does, in fact, today affect, when civil matters go through the process based on the number of criminal trials that have to be heard. They have a preferential treatment in front of the court.
Chief, you want to go or you want me to?
Well, let me, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, that's true today in some counties. The slowing down because of the heavy criminal caseload, it's going to be more so when we click into our 4-day week and close the courthouses on Friday and some of the other things. I've heard Judge Kosh, who's the presiding judge in Multnomah County, where significant business cases are tried, or civil cases, that it's going to be very hard to get a civil case out in Multnomah County after March 1st.
If I could follow up. It's also my understanding that Lane County is somewhat of a model of being on that fast-track program as to being able to expedite cases, realizing that, as the Chief Justice has said, that in other parts of the state, it takes much longer for a civil case to go forward. And I'd say the other point is that with the consolidation of the district court into the circuit court, the numbers we are seeing are now going into one level of court versus having a minor or different level of trial court for areas of violations or small traffic infraction type stuff.
Yes, Mr. Chief.
Mr. Chairman, responding to Representative Prozanski, there is a table on page 38 of our handout that the Oregon Judicial Conference has set goals for disposition of cases, and that's in the left-hand side there, for instance. Civil cases, 98% will be resolved within 18 months, and then you go on down the line. And you'll see the box score as we come across. In some areas, we're on top of the goal, but you can see slippage starting, and I predict that that will continue. We keep missing the disposition lines, and there'll be a lower percentage of cases disposed of within our preferred timeline.
Thank you. And I just want to remind the committee again, what we've had here, I think, has been a very engaging discussion. Much of the meat of the operational information that you need to understand as we move through the next part of this session is contained in this very useful material that the court has prepared for us. So I'd encourage you over the weekend, when you're sitting up at the lounge, when you're looking for something to read, when you go home at night, take this with you and spend a few minutes going over that. I think you'll find some of the statistics to be quite revealing and helpful as we move forward. Chief, do you have anything further you'd like to add before we close?
No, you've been very gracious to allow us this opportunity. I want to thank you and the members of the committee for putting up with us for the past.
Well, thank you and all of your honors for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. I'm going to deviate for about 30 seconds on the program, and we're going to introduce quickly if Bob Olson and a couple of folks from the bar would come forward for a couple of quick introductions, and then we'll move right into the Attorney General and the Department of Justice presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Olson, Oregon State Bar. I did want to touch base. Many of you have seen our handout before on the law improvement bills and been seeing them filed. We put in about 30 law improvement bills each session. Almost all of them have already been printed. I wanted to introduce the people that will be working with me this session on law improvement. Susan Grady, our Government Relations Manager, and Joyce Patton, also an attorney in our office. Right in front of them is Tom Kranovich. Tom, could you stand up? Tom is going to be the chair of the Judicial Administration Committee of the Bar. They have their organizational meeting tomorrow afternoon. He's an insurance defense lawyer from Milwaukee, and I think that committee will, again, be a real good resource on some of the administrative issues that practitioners get involved in. So, and I'd be glad privately to answer any questions about the bills, or we'll be coming and seeing people on particular bills. One of the resource people you won't see a lot, but he is available, is our general counsel, George Reamer. He testified yesterday on indigent defense, and he talked about our priorities in terms of access in the court system and law improvement. But initially, the law improvement effort, which is what will take up most of our time and effort. And I guess the only other thing I would mention is that we do have a legal services office in our office, and we'll be doing trying to do more law-related constituent problems. Representative Williams got us more active in that last session, and with this staff person in our office, we're able to help legislators who have constituent problems get information and a timely response. So feel free to call on us if you see a particular constituent problems that you think are law-related. So appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Bob. I can't help but just point out that Tom Kranovich was actually the adjunct professor who taught my mock trial moot court class when I attended law school. So it's always good to see Tom and remember those days. Thank you. We would now ask to move to the next part of the program and invite the Attorney General, Hardy Myers, to come forward, and whoever else you wish to bring forward, Attorney General.
Thank you, Chair Williams, members. For your record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Ronell Schenkel, who is our legislative liaison. I'd also like to introduce Kevin Neely, who is not on my left, who is my executive assistant. For those of you who worked with Kristen Granger in prior sessions, Kevin is in the position that she held and will be acting as our public information officer, and will have some legislative contact. He will be our legislative coordinator, and Ronell has come over from the Division of Child Support to take a significant part of Kristen Granger's legislative activities for this session. She was the head of the principal legislative representative of the Division of Child Support in the last three sessions, and I have asked her to join my immediate staff to help us with the wider legislative work of the department. We're very pleased to have this opportunity to appear before you. As I have mentioned on one or more prior appearances before the committee, I have the privilege of chairing the House Committee on Judiciary when I was a state representative. And so I retain a particular affection, if you will, and certainly respect for the work of this committee. I think it is one of the real workhorse committees of the Assembly. I have a very keen appreciation of the immensity of its workload and its great public importance of a number and sensitivity of a lot of the issues that come before you. We will be before you a number of times on measures that we ourselves have introduced as a department, and certainly I hope that we will have the opportunity to be a resource to the committee in the wider sense whenever you determine that that might be helpful to you. We've distributed a very small packet of documents, which we're referring to here as we go along. We will have a somewhat more, a larger, organized kind of reference set of documents for you shortly that pertain to the Department of Justice, a reference manual, if you will, that we hope will be helpful in your interactions with the department during the legislative session and thereafter, for that matter. Let me start by noting, if I could, before I go to the actual organization and work of the department, if you would look on the back page where the organizational chart is printed, we have set forth the current mission statement of the department, and I note it simply because I think it seeks to capture our present vision of the work of the department as the legislature has defined it, and that is while we are serving different constituencies in the different areas of responsibility, as will become clear in a moment, the government itself, members of the public, district attorneys, but we view all of those missions as linked by a common goal, which is to try to advance the rule of law in Oregon in different settings as to both government and individuals. That's the way we presently try to think about our cooperation, our contribution to the quality of life in Oregon. Similarly, or rather in a related sense, we have set forth as the next document the primary statutory sources of responsibility and authority within the Department of Justice and for the Attorney General that the legislature has enacted over time. We have not included the entirety of Chapter 180, which is the key section or chapter, rather, of ORS. We will have that as part of the reference manual that I mentioned earlier. Let me then go first to a look at the top organization or leadership of the department, and then we'll move across our division lines of activity and give you that overview. The department is by law headed by the Attorney General, and the Deputy Attorney General, Peter Shepherd, that is also a statutory position. That is not a box on the organizational chart that an Attorney General is free to retain or wipe off, and the legislature has vested the deputy with all the authority of the Attorney General when the Attorney General is, for one reason or another, not available to exercise the office's authority and responsibility. The Associate Attorney General acts really as kind of the administrative lieutenant of the Attorney General. Leslie Bonney, she works exclusively on internal administrative and personnel matters. The deputy is more directed, of course, toward law and policy, if you will, though the two work together frequently on administration. The two special counsels, Stephanie Striffler and Philip Schradl, both I think will be before this committee probably several times during the session. I imagine the returning members are acquainted with both of them. They act as kind of directors of special projects and have special lines of responsibility under my overall leadership. Stephanie, for example, is the coordinator of Indian Affairs within the Department of Justice, and it is her responsibility to be aware of all matters occurring in the department that have a tribal connection to them, and she also participates as the department's representative in the negotiation of Indian gaming compacts. Mr. Schradl is reviews all amicus opinion or decision amicus briefing requests. He participates in evaluating initiative petitions that are filed with the Secretary of State for compliance with applicable provisions of the Constitution that deal with the use of the initiative. He has a number of several lines of special responsibility. And then, as I've mentioned, Mr. Neely and Ronell Schenkel are involved with Mr. Neely with public information functions, Kevin, and the and legislative coordination, and Ronell as our legislative liaison. Let me begin the review of the different lines of responsibility and areas of work of the department by asking Ronell to give you the overview of our child support division's work. This is our largest division. It is probably the one that on an ongoing basis affects more individual Oregonians than any other part of the department's operations. Then I will give you an overview of how the legal divisions are organized and operate.
Good afternoon. Again, for the record, I'm Ron L. Shankle, and as Hardy mentioned, I will be serving as one of his legislative liaisons. Outside of session, normally the title that I have is I'm within the Child Support Program, the Assistant Director, responsible for the section that houses policy, rules, and legislation. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Oregon Child Support Program broadly, in which the Department of Justice Division of Child Support plays a very key role. And first, I'll briefly tell you about the mission of the program. You have in your documents, starting with the fourth sheet, a layout of the current Child Support Program structure in Oregon, and behind that on the back, the mission of the program in Oregon. But basically, we are a public service that enhances the well-being of Oregon's children. That's our primary focus, is the children. And as demographics of our society change, the need for child support services has only grown over the years. It's an increasingly important focus both at the national level as well as the state level. And today, most of America's children live in a very different scenario than they did in years gone by, where we could count on the fact that children would live with an intact family for their entire childhood. Statistics today show that more than half of our nation's children will spend at least part of their childhood in a single-parent situation. And so child support programs are very involved in the lives of the families that they serve. Oftentimes, the work of our program is a primary piece in the self-sufficiency of a family and keeping those families able to provide for themselves and not become dependent on state assistance. Today in Oregon's Child Support Program, our total caseload is just over 250,000 cases. And we'll talk more about how those cases are spread out in a moment. Basic program structure. In Oregon, our program was first established in 1975. Part of the Social Security Act, Title 4D, is where you find the requirements for child support programs. And at the federal level, it's the Office of Child Support Enforcement, which is part of the Department of Health and Human Services, that is responsible for our oversight to the states as well as federal funding. And we interact with Region 10 of the Office of Child Support Enforcement. Oregon is in that region along with Washington, Alaska, and Idaho. Then bringing that down to the state level, currently under statute in Oregon, the directorship responsibility for the Child Support Program resides actually with the Department of Human Services. So they are responsible for the oversight, the basic policy, and the budget of the Child Support Program to date. However, there is action afoot, and the interim judiciary was very involved and has, in fact, introduced a consolidation bill that you will be hearing more about, I hope. And that looks towards moving what are the state agency portions of Oregon's Child Support Program all together within the Department of Justice and the Division of Child Support. So those remaining pieces that are currently in Department of Human Services would presumably move over to the department. And then, of course, we will still have the partnership with the county district attorneys. So what has happened during this interim at the direction of the Judiciary Committee is we have what you see on the organization chart before you, an interagency team that is currently running Oregon's Child Support Program. Cindy Chinock, who is normally the administrator of the Division of Child Support, has taken a leave of absence to step into the role of director over at Department of Human Services. We then took the program staff responsible for policy and budget and finance from that agency and moved in together here in Salem with the administrative staff from the Division of Child Support. Bringing in with us, you'll note the district attorney liaison, Roger Wong, is also on our team, and together we're all running the Child Support Program in a new way. On the cases and how they're distributed in Oregon, basically the Department of Human Services contracts all of the services directly to families out to the Department of Justice and to the county district attorneys. The Department of Justice and the Division of Child Support get that portion of the caseload where the child either is receiving or has received in the past some type of state assistance. That might be temporary assistance to needy families or welfare payments. It might be the Oregon Health Plan. It might be spending some time in a foster care scenario or a juvenile care scenario through Oregon Youth Authority. All of those cases, through an automated system, are automatically referred over to our division and begin receiving services. The district attorneys then provide services to the cases that we call private cases, so to speak, in Oregon. Those are families with children that have not received any type of assistance from the state of Oregon, and those are assigned out to their respective counties for services. For the Division of Child Support, we currently have 6 regions established in the state, and we have, I believe, currently 17 local branch offices throughout the state. We have 3 regions that we call our field operations, and they provide all of the same services throughout the state. It does not differ, and it should not matter where you are in the state of Oregon. You should be receiving the same child support program services. We have a centralized operation region that has those services that are either federally mandated to stay centralized, such as our statewide disbursement unit, and some services that just make good business sense to be done on a centralized basis. For the county district attorneys, currently 28 of our 36 counties are providing child support program services as well. And there are 8 that for various reasons have chosen not to do so. And in those instances, the Department of Human Services contracts with our Department of Justice to provide services for the private cases as well. Those 8 services, those 8 counties are Lake, Lynn, Gillum, Hood River, Sherman, Wheeler, Jefferson, and Deschutes. And all of this information will be in the reference book that Hardy referred to. Hopefully we'll have those available to you next week. The majority of the services done by the Oregon Child Support Program are done using the administrative process, although we certainly do venture into the judicial arena and work with the judges that you heard before us. In the administrative process for our contested cases, by contract, we use the Employment Department Central Hearings Officer panel to hear our child support cases. There are basically 6 primary service areas that the child support program provides, and I'll walk you through those briefly. Locating absent parents sometimes is the first step of any case. We need to find that parent that is no longer in the household with the children. And during state fiscal year 2002, and I might mention, by the way, locate services are by contract done for the entire program by our Division of Child Support staff. And so the staff of our division during state fiscal year 2002 processed 31,249 locate requests on our caseload in Oregon. The next step for many cases is that of establishing paternity. Many children today are born out of wedlock, and before you can take action to establish a child support order, you first have to establish who that legal father is. There are several ways that paternity can be established. The simplest way is through a process called voluntary acknowledgments, and that basically is, I think, a 1-page, perhaps 2, sworn affidavit where a man signs and says that I am the father of this child. I admit that and agree to that, and that is and becomes a legal order with the same effect as if we had gone through a process to establish paternity. So those services are available not only through the program, but through most of the hospitals, birthing centers, and so on in the state. For those parents that don't voluntarily establish paternity, then we do go through a legal process for those families, and we can do that both administratively and judicially. And in those cases where there is an uncertainty and either the mother or the father does not know for sure who the true father is, we do genetic testing as part of that process. And genetic testing can either be blood testing, but more commonly, and the majority of our testing in Oregon is done by a process called buccal swab, which is basically taking some saliva on a Q-tip looking device from the inside of each of the parents' mouths and the child. And through that, we can go through a DNA process to establish a paternity index. In state fiscal year 2002, we established for the entire program's caseload 12,522 paternity. So that would be a combination of both those parents who are voluntarily acknowledging and the legal actions that we establish. Next step is to establish the child support order itself. Child support orders deal with both the monetary monthly support for a child, but also health insurance coverage. And oftentimes after we establish orders, we're also involved then in modifying them to keep those orders current and accurate and reflecting the needs and the abilities of the family at any given time. During state fiscal year 2002, the Oregon Child Support Program entered 12,359 orders, and we did 2,936 modifications. Modifications briefly can be done on a child support order as soon as they are 2 years old. So simply the passage of time qualifies you to have your case reviewed to see if it's still in compliance and it's still appropriate. Or at any time sooner, if one of the parents tells us that there has been a significant change of circumstances, that will be evaluated and a modification action may be appropriate. Modifications, you never know the outcome. The child support order may result in a higher amount or a lower amount. It depends on the scenarios and the factors involved. For all of our establishment of orders and our modification of orders, we use what are called the Oregon Child Support Guidelines. Those same guidelines are used statewide by the child support program practitioners, by circuit court judges, by private attorneys working with families. By statute, it is the Department of Justice Division of Child Support who's responsible for maintaining Oregon's guidelines, and that is done through the administrative rule process. And our guidelines can be found on our website, or there will be information in the materials we provide to you in your manual about how you can obtain a copy of those rules. It's a whole series of rules established to cover the myriad of details that are involved in a calculation. Oregon is currently in a four-year review process. The federal government requires all states to look at their guidelines every 4 years and make sure they still fit, both for the economy but also for the families and the scenarios in your state. And we are in the middle of that process. In fact, we are in the notice of proposed rulemaking right now, and hearings will be taking place throughout the state about Oregon's guidelines. The next step is the one that is most commonly known for the child support program, and that's the enforcement of the orders. That's making certain that the payments are being made, that the money is being collected, and that the health insurance is being enforced and coverage is there for the children. The primary method for collecting child support is income withholding. And income withholding is not, for child support purposes, is not a garnishment. It is an income withholding, which is a separate process and is much more similar to a payroll deduction. Your employer would be served with a notice that there's an order and a monthly obligation. They would be told how much money needs to be sent in each month, and that would simply come up out of the payroll and be sent into the child support program. Since 1993, when we passed, again, a federal mandate, but laws in Oregon, all new or modified orders are required to have, with some very narrow exceptions, income withholding language, and that's why that is the primary tool for collection and payment of child support. If a person is self-employed, for example, or income withholding is not successful because they do contract work or change jobs a lot, we have many other administrative tools we use. Briefly, we do a high number of garnishments. We garnish bank accounts as well as lottery winnings. There are all types of assets that we can use administrative garnishments for. We do unemployment compensation withholdings. We have the ability to intercept both state and federal tax refunds. We have the ability to intercept bail monies that are posted. And, of course, we have the ever-popular license suspension program for child support that I'm sure all of you have probably heard about. And if you haven't, you are likely to hear about this session. We have the ability to suspend any occupational as well as driver's and recreational licenses for failure to pay child support. We do then have judicial remedies that are sometimes used on those cases, which are more severe in the non-payment, such as contempt actions and criminal non-support. Briefly, 54% of our total collections in the program are done through the income withholding, and the others play out from there. You will receive a pie chart from us that shows all the different types of collections and what percentage of actions they represent. During the biennium 1999 and 2001, we collected the total amount in Oregon for child support was just over $547 million. We project that in the biennium that we're just finishing up, 2001-2003, we will collect over $605 million in child support in Oregon. Another important service is accounting and distribution. The federal laws require, and Oregon has adopted statutes that reflect, all child support payments need to be processed through, again with some very limited exceptions, through the Oregon Child Support Program. So even if you're not receiving our full services, it is very likely that your payments process through our computer so that there is a record of those payments and accounting. Our receipting unit is, again, one of those contract areas where all of that work is done by the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. And in state fiscal year 2002, we processed over 1 million payments through that state disbursement unit. We also have our final service, which are interstate cases, sometimes the most difficult of cases. And those either involve us having the child and custodial parent in Oregon and the absent parent in some other state, or exactly the reverse. We are either initiating an action and asking for another state to work with us, or have a partner state coming into Oregon and asking for our services. All of the states have reciprocity, and we have very strong interstate laws for child support, so that simply crossing state lines is no longer an easy out from your child support obligation. In Oregon, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, which are our primary child support interstate laws, are in Chapter 110. I'm just going to mention a couple of other brief sort of environmental issues for the child support program that may be of importance to you this session. One is the importance, I believe, of understanding that our caseload has been changing for many years now. Originally, for those of you that have been involved in family law, you may remember that we started out being the Welfare Recovery Division. That was when our primary job was to be a collection agency for the state to offset those costs of services to families. We're a long way from that today. There is a federal, many federal directions in our laws that place an emphasis today on making sure that the money we collect first goes to the families and last goes to reimburse the states. That has been a growing trend for several years, and if you are familiar with our child support laws, you will see that reflected. The first emphasis for Oregon's program is to get money flowing to families to help them avoid the need for the state services. We also place great importance on reimbursing the state for those families who need our assistance, but it generally in all of our actions will be money to the families first. Another important piece of the work of the child support program that is a change, although it's been under discussion for several years, is the addition of a requirement, and you will see a bill from our department this session, for the child support program to take a greater role in the enforcement of health insurance. You will be hearing a lot more about the National Medical Support Notice from myself and our other liaison, and we won't go into those details today. But the federal government has decided that it's the child support programs that are the best place to be looking at ensuring that our children have health care coverage. The final piece that I would mention is that of positive partnerships. The child support program, and especially during the legislative session, works in close partnership, mostly through the efforts of our Division of Child Support with some other state agencies, such as Department of Human Services, where many of our cases come from, Oregon Youth Authority, and the Judicial Department. During session, we are also very involved with Oregon State Bar, and you met their representatives just before we came to the table. The final piece I want to mention, because I know it's something that if you haven't dealt with it in the past, and many of you have because I've been in your offices, and if you're new, you probably will have constituents that want to talk about child support. We hear from many of the members each session that that is the number one constituent issue. So I will point out to you that at the very back of your packet, and again, you will receive more materials in our book next week, but the last page has various contacts for the Department of Justice. You have Kevin Neely and I for any legislative matters you wish to discuss. Myself and Tammy Kramer, who specialize, so to speak, in child support. But the third piece is probably the most important piece. You are certainly welcome to contact us, but if you wish to go directly to the source, we have a child support constituent desk that the Department of Justice Division of Child Support manages and maintains, and those two people do nothing but help your constituents Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So you are welcome to use them as a contact if you cannot reach one of us. So those would conclude my comments about the Division of Child Support at this time.
Let me just say before we move on, Mr. Attorney General, that if you haven't already gotten calls, you new elected members, about child support, you will. I will just tell you that the first line of defense in responding to those calls is to have your staff be well acquainted with these folks over at the desk that handle these constituent calls. They're extremely responsive and extremely helpful, and will relieve your staff of an incredible burden in trying to do this on their own, because it's almost impossible to figure it out without folks over there helping. So I just want to encourage you to use that service, and thank you again for making that available to us in the legislature. Mr. Attorney General, Representative Jensen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I almost was going to take exception to what you were saying there, because given the numbers she was talking about and the numbers of calls I've had, I thought that I was the only representative in the state that was getting those calls, because if everybody got as many as I did, the numbers would have had to have been much higher.
We did. You're a little part of the state, Representative.
Must be. It must be the sand or something that causes it to take place over there. I did have only one real quick question. And what are the conditions that allow a county to kind of opt out of the child support thing? You mentioned 8 counties that are not, and at least as I'm looking at this, as far as my county, that's a fairly significant load on the district attorney's office. And why are we paying for it and other counties aren't?
Chair Williams and Representative Jensen, there are no specific requirements in the statute as to whether or not a district attorney and a county chooses to participate in our program. Some of our counties, such as Linn County, have been contracted for as long as I can remember, before my time with the program, and I've been with the program 12 years. Others are more recent, and in general it has to do with resource issues. But for each county, when the discussion takes place, the director talks with the attorney general and the elected DA and looks at resources on both sides of the equation, and each individual county would be an individual negotiation to make sure that we'll still provide the best services that we can to those families.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I might add, Representative Jensen, that we are definitely, however, reached the point where we would not be able to accept another county to take over another county's responsibility.
You're asking me not to recruit for you.
I was going to say, without additional resources. Let me now turn, if I may, to the work of within the legal divisions of the department, and I want to start with the work that the department has been given in terms of its role as what I'll call the law center for state government. The legislature made a tremendously significant decision 30-some years ago when it decided to consolidate all of the legal services of the government, that is to say, at least the executive department of the government, in the Department of Justice and under the Attorney General, as opposed to having the attorneys out working for individual agencies, employed by individual agencies, uncoordinated or unconnected with each other. And if I could, one of my definite impressions from my activity in the National Association of Attorneys General is that to the extent there are reform efforts in states dealing with the way state legal services are organized, it is invariably in the direction that Oregon took 3 decades ago. It is to consolidate those services under a single accountable official. And that action gives you the capability of having attorneys who have can have independence of judgment because their continued employment doesn't depend on they're necessarily telling the government in all instances what it wants to hear. By consolidating the lawyers, you have a chance to work collegially on issues. You have a chance to try to attain consistency of advice. And you can create a career path for your attorneys in the sense that over time they may seek to move within the department to different practice areas. We've organized that work for the government into 3 or 4 different divisions. That's what I'd like to take just a second to review for. If you would refer to either the small or the large organizational chart, the first division I mentioned is the general counsel division. This is where we have organized the lawyers who are providing daily legal advice to agencies, interpretations of state or federal law, drafting of administrative rules, and a variety of services, and virtually any legal advice that issues from the department almost invariably will come out of the general counsel division. And we've grouped the lawyers in that division really into what are in effect little law firms. I'm required by Oregon law to appoint an assistant attorney general to be the chief lawyer for every state agency or board or commission. And then we in turn group these different groupings of lawyers according to the agencies that they serve. We try to group agencies together that have some logical connection to one another for the most part. 2 exceptions to that, labor and employment section serves all of the government, of course, and the business transactions section, which deals with the government's contracting, for the most part, also serves all agencies. For the litigation needs of the government, we have the trial division, which represents the government when it is a defendant in lawsuits. And across a wide variety of litigation, and we have organized the work of the trial division into somewhat specialized areas of practice to permit some measure of concentration and development of expertise. If you move over two boxes to the center, civil enforcement division, we have there the civil recovery division, and that is where the lawyers we have the lawyers who represent the state ordinarily when it is a plaintiff in a lawsuit, usually seeking some form of money recovery, and also represent the state interests in bankruptcy proceedings. That section, for example, is where the new Clarissa litigation was footed, which I'm pleased to say we were able to win. A variety of different kinds of state claims for money that are handled out of the Civil Recovery Division. Then we have in the trial, if I go back to the trial division for just a moment, that is also where we have the work of representing the state in response to post-conviction relief petitions and state and federal habeas corpus cases. Then to move over to the second line, to the appellate division, the department is charged to represent the state's interests in all civil and criminal appeals to which the state is a party. That's going to be in part civil administrative appeals, and then, but more dominantly in terms of numbers, appeals of direct appeals of criminal convictions obtained by district attorneys in circuit courts in Oregon. And that work, in turn, both the civil and criminal, is broken up into smaller working groups of lawyers for purposes of, in part, of developing sort of concentrated expertise in particular areas. If I could go back to the Civil Enforcement Division for a moment, it's in that division that we also have the Family Law Section, which advises the Department of Child Support, acts as its lawyers, an internal client, if you will, as well as representing the state when there are enforcement proceedings dealing with child support, and also represents the state in termination of parental rights cases. In that division, we also have our Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, which is probably the part of the department alongside child support that interacts with the largest number of individual Oregonians on an ongoing basis, and which I think probably is maybe the most publicized part of the Attorney General's Department of Justice's activities and responsibilities. And that is the part of the department where we not only administer the basic consumer protection law of Oregon, but also that is also where our antitrust law-related activities are centered. And then finally, in the civil enforcement division, we have the Medicaid Fraud Unit, which we are required by federal law to maintain, to ferret out and prosecute both financial fraud in the Medicaid program as well as the financial or physical mistreatment of patients, if you will, of facilities that are financed with Medicaid funding assistance. And then finally, the Charitable Activities section. This is the section that's responsible for carrying out the responsibilities of the Attorney General and Department of Justice as to charitable corporations in Oregon, to maintain some measure of oversight over their activities, and also to regulate fundraising by charities as well as gaming by charities. Finally, but very importantly, the Criminal Justice Division, which is organized into three different areas. One part is our District Attorney Assistance Program. One of the really, I think, outstanding decisions of the legislature was recognizing the highly varying level of resources that DAs around our state have. And we have some counties in which the DA is alone, doesn't have a single deputy. Legislature has created this sort of central pool of investigative and prosecution resources to which district attorneys can come for assistance when they need it. That happens most often in aggravated murder and murder cases, though at times in others as well. And this central pool of resources is available to help them. That section also issues various publications of great importance to the prosecuting bar, including the search and seizure manual. The organized crime section is focused primarily on malfeasance in office by office holders, and also has, I think, developed an increasing specialization around white-collar type criminal situations. And then finally, it's also under the organized crime section that we operate the criminal intelligence unit, which the legislature has established in the Department of Justice. And then finally, the crime victims assistance section, which is the state center for service to victims of crime in Oregon. We administer the crime victims compensation program in that section, and it is through that section that flows all of the money that goes out to assist DA victim assistance programs, as well as private nonprofits that provide services to crime victims. And also, since last session, it is through that section that flows the funding for the CAMI program, which was brought over to the department by the legislature in 2001.
And for those new members, you might describe CAMI for us.
Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program. It is intended to professionalize, if you will, the response to and treatment of child sexual abuse, primarily in Oregon, through assessment and advocacy centers. Final quick comment, the Administrative Services section, of course, extremely important part of the department in terms of its ongoing operations, and it is in turn divided into four different areas as shown for purposes of the service it renders to the department. I'd like to mention just quickly two or three other areas of activity that aren't shown by the box and that I haven't mentioned earlier. One is defense of initiative measures. The department acts in the role of defending or upholding initiative measures when they have been passed by the people and have been challenged in court. A very significant area of responsibility, and it is one in which there has been a great deal of activity over the last several years. The department is also charged, the Attorney General is also charged to prepare the ballot titles for initiative measures. And that is handled in the appellate division by a team in the appellate division. And we wrote, I'm trying to remember, 200 plus, I think, ballot titles in the last cycle. For every preliminary petition filed that we recommend the Secretary of State process in terms of our evaluating that we believe it complies with constitutional requirements for use of the initiative process, a ballot title must be generated, and if it's challenged in the Supreme Court, we defend it. So it's an immense, immense amount of activity. Third area of activity I would mention is law improvement. I came into office feeling that the Department of Justice ought to be a major center of law improvement proposal development and activity, because our lawyers are working across the whole spectrum of state law and are in a position uniquely to be aware of anachronisms, lack of clarity, outdated, outmoded provisions of Oregon law in one or another area, or provisions that just need modernization or change for some other reason. We established an internal working group called the Law Improvement Steering Committee, which consists of a representative from each of our divisions. That committee acts to draw proposals, recommendations for possible law improvement. Those are worked through. The committee ultimately arrives at a set of recommended concepts for me to review and either approve or disapprove, and those have been transmitted to Legislative Council and are prepared as the legislative package of the Department of Justice. We will have 50 bills sponsored by the department in this session, some number of them, I would expect, if the chair agrees they are worth spending time on, will be before this committee, and certainly we will try to participate with you in considering them in as efficient and organized way as possible so as to make the least claim we can on your time. As I mentioned earlier, I know well from my own service on this committee what a tremendous time management challenge it faces, and we want to try to be a helping resource in that regard and not make unjustifiable or uncontrolled claims on your valuable committee time. I think that with that, Mr. Chair and members, I will conclude my overview comments, and if there are any questions that I could respond to, I'd be happy to try to do so.
Are there questions for the Attorney General? There appears to be none. Oh, no, I Representative Jensen.
Just a quick and probably trivia question, but is it your organized crime division there that would investigate the eco-terrorism as appeared under the RICO bills of last...
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes.
Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate your patience and your presentation.
Thank you very much.
And we'll adjourn.